Seattle's Morning News. Dave Ross with Colleen O'Brien. It was last June that flyers with candy attached were distributed around Bellevue and Clyde Hill. They were linked to a neo-Nazi group called the Patriot Front. And Dyer Oxley from MyNorthwest.com decided to find out who these guys are and should we be afraid of them. I'm guessing they would tell you, well, we're your neighbors, and no, you shouldn't be afraid of us.
Yeah, I think that's the key word here is branding, you know.
Branding.
I think, yeah, the idea is when you see these flyers, they're usually on hot-button topics, immigration, communism. They're very surface level, nothing that screams white supremacy.
Mm-hmm.
But they kind of bring you in, inviting on those surface topics, hoping you don't really go too much further. But you might notice certain things, like the website Blood and Soil on the flyer. For those who are unaware of history, that is a Nazi mantra from World War II. It implies a ethno-state, as Germany tried to do at the time. So certain groups might not present themselves as the old classic skinhead swastika tattoo groups that you are familiar with. These days, it's more khakis and it's more flyers.
What do the flyers say?
The first flyers, the ones you said in Clyde Hill, were actually one of the first instances that we saw. They had a more recent one as well. The first one said, if you see illegal immigrants, you should report them. It was a legal immigration issue, hot-button issue. The second one was better dead than red, anti-communism slogan. Yes. Those were plastered around Tacoma and around West Seattle. And they forward you to their website. Now, their website, if you look at it, you will not find white supremacy, white homeland. I think if you look through it a little bit, you might find some quotes from some Americans from days of old talking about Jewish people that mm-hmm. might raise an eyebrow. But for the most part, it's not presenting itself, aside from the fact all these people are wearing masks on the website. But
wait, you're burying the lead there.
Oh, yeah, they're wearing masks, the mask or American flags, but they don't present themselves as anything other than a patriot American group. Whenever we report on this, the online conversation generally comes back at us as, wait a minute, I have strong opinions about illegal immigration,
right.
So does that make me a neo-Nazi? And there's a short answer and a long answer to that. The short answer is no. Having opinions about immigration does not make you a neo-Nazi, and that's the very surface-level consideration that I think is being shot for here.
But spreading fear through the neighborhood,
yes.
That's something else, right?
Yes.
Although, would they argue that since we want to get illegal aliens out of the country, they should be afraid because they're here illegally?
Yeah, well, they might say that. I think there's a larger picture here that is these groups have for decades now been trying to form a white ethno-state in the Northwest. For a couple decades, there have been multiple groups within the white supremacy community that want to form just a nation of white people out of the Northwest. They think it's one of their last chances to do it.
Did you ask them how they would go about forming this state? And when you form this state, what do you do with the people already living there?
Basically, they just need to leave is the answer.
Need to leave is one thing,
leave.
But forced to leave would be something else. What is that? You know, what do they intend to do?
It depends on who you ask. If you look at, there's a hate map online. If you look at the groups that are out there, there's many different takes to this. There's some folks that are very Norse heritage oriented. There's a lot of groups that are neo-Nazi oriented. There's some groups that kind of couch this in Christian identity.
Yeah, where does the Christian part come here? I see nothing Christian about this.
Exactly. And I think a lot of folks would tell you that. The thing is, these groups kind of ebb and flow in between each other.
Christ was a Palestinian, as far as I can tell.
Exactly. And there's a Jewish connection, too. So their approach to this is very different depending on which group you find yourself with. And if we're talking about Patriot Front, I think their approach here is more, we are Americans. And what their view of America is, beyond that, is probably what they want you to slowly come into. So kind of case in point, I talked to the Anti-Defamation League about who this group was and what exactly they were doing, because they don't present themselves outwardly as a white supremacist organization. I caught up with Miri Cypers, who basically just answered, who was Patriot Front?
Patriot Front is a white supremacist organization that we would classify as being on the alt-right. They try to paint themselves as an American nationalist group, but in reality, they're an organization that is intolerant, that is racist and anti-Semitic that envisions an America that's only for white people. They were started after the rally in Charlottesville, Virginia. They're based in Texas, but they have groups and individuals all over the country with a particularly active group in the Pacific Northwest.
That active group, of course, is the folks putting flyers around in Tacoma, West Seattle, Bellevue, and so forth. And they've also done some vandalism at some billboards in Tacoma that they've filmed video and showing themselves doing. So.
Yeah. So just based on your investigation, how should people react when some of this shows up with candy attached in the front yard?
So the main response that I think folks have been having that is good is awareness. Because like I said, branding seems to be the new approach. It's not a skinhead guy with a swastika tattooed on his forehead. It is somebody who doesn't appear like that. And they show up saying patriot. And they show up saying American pride. They don't show up saying white power. So that is the awareness that I think folks are starting to realize they need to have. And they need to be more aware of when they get something that maybe you should look a little bit deeper before you buy into something.
And back to my first question, are these groups filled with people we should be scared of?
I asked that question to Sheriff Ozzie Kanosevich in Spokane, and he would answer yes. He was in a Martin Luther King parade in 2011 that someone planted a bomb in, and that person was from one of these groups. Mm-hmm. So he would say that, yes, there are people that we should feel are dangerous. And just this week, there was a white nationalist member of the Coast Guard who was arrested.
That's
who was
right.
Stockpiling weapons. And he wrote specifically on the Northwest territory for white people. So there would be people that I think you could say that are dangerous. On the other hand, numbers and membership in these organizations is highly unknown.
Yeah.
So who knows if there's a lot, who knows if there's not, but it only really takes one.
So these are not merely people holding racist ideas. These include people who are willing to act out in violent ways on those ideas.
Some, I would say yes, because they have and have been proven to do that.
Dyer Oxley from MyNorthwest.com. That's where you can find his articles on sugarcoating white supremacy. Dyer, thanks.
Thank you.
Hannah Scott is here now. The search continues for some solution to the opioid crisis. Tacoma and Pierce County's second annual opioid summit is going to be held today. What will they discuss, Hannah?
So Tacoma and Pierce County have been hit especially hard by the opioid crisis and have some of the highest drug-related crime and overdose rates in the state, with the biggest increase in overdoses among young people between 15 and 34 in their neck of the woods. They declared an opioid crisis in 2017, and the city and county created an opioid task force at that point. And Tacoma City Councilman Connor McCarthy says it was right after that that they held their first opioid summit, this time last year.
Really just get everyone who's seeing this issue in their different professions, whether that's firefighters responding to emergency calls, physicians who are seeing patients who are now requesting treatment for an opioid addiction. What kinds of tacks can we take as a community to make sure that we actually have a system in place to try and drive down the use and abuse of opioids and the addiction and all the negative stuff that's associated with it?
So he says it became clear after that the best way to play offense here was to really make sure that all of the agencies are talking to one another. It's a lot like what we've seen in the Snohomish County area, where they really have everyone communicating, coordinating their response, right? So today they're going to continue that effort with this summit, where elected officials, doctors, firefighters, police, all kinds of other experts are going to come together, look at what they've done over the past year to come up with a plan moving forward. And McCarthy says during the past year, the city and county have also looked to East Coast cities that are making progress in their own approach to the opioid crisis.
To really try and learn what the best practices they have in place. Because at the end of the day, in our community right now, the problem is it takes too long to get treatment. There's not enough treatment available. There's a negative stigma associated with some treatment providers even providing this treatment or citing a treatment facility. Right now we have a system that can't deliver, for example, what other communities can back east, which is the promise of medically assisted treatment within a very short period of time.
So that's something they're going to work on. But they've also made some big strides from what they've learned from those East Coast cities, including setting up a system in jails to help people in opioid withdrawal get connected with Suboxone treatment. And again, like Snohomish County, once those people are released from jail, getting that continuity of care, right? Making sure that they continue to get that care once they're released. And they are about to launch a first of its kind for our state pilot program in their fire stations.
Taking one to two fire stations and opening the doors and telling the public, look, if you're ready for treatment, you can come here. This is a safe place. And when you show up, they'll determine whether or not they need to go to the emergency room or not. And then there'll be an actual protocol for transporting to a treatment center. If it's not within normal business hours, we'll have a place to go for people pending that a time that we can get them into treatment.
Wow. So you just walk. So you're in a crisis.
Yep.
You say, I've had it. I want to. You just walk to the fire station and they'll take it from there.
Yeah. They'll do a little assessment for you, get you that hooked up with that case management, help transport you wherever you need to go, get you into whatever level of treatment it is you need. Let me tell you, this is a very cool program. It's something that they found in visiting with Manchester, New Hampshire, where the fire station there does this program.
Someone who worked for them just thought it up one day after they lost a loved one, and they opened up a few fire stations, and before you know it, they had, over the course of the past several years, you know, thousands of people come through the door and get connected to treatment.
So that's an exciting program. Again, that's supposed to launch any time now. I believe the next month is when he said that will start.
That's the first genuinely new thing I've heard in this
discussion,
right?
Yeah, I was very excited, just like you. I said, wait, let's go back to that. So I'm excited, and I will follow up to see how that goes and get some more details on that. Treatment is, again, when we're talking about Suboxone medication-based treatment. Everyone I've talked to here says that this is really vital. And according to William Moyers, who is vice president of the Hazelton Betty Ford Clinic, who is going to be speaking today at this opioid summit, he knows firsthand just how difficult the struggle with addiction is and how important all of these treatments are.
It's easy to stop using. I stopped using 1,000 times. It's hard to stay stopped. And to stay stopped means being committed and using all of those tools that are part of the recovery process, even if that's, as I said, medication to manage cravings. And so whether it's spirituality or 12 steps or medication or community, there are many tools that I use to continue to walk my walk a day at a time for a long time now.
And he has a pretty incredible story. He shared with me that in the 80s, he had a crack addiction, a very severe crack addiction. He got off of that, stayed clean for a long time. Six, 7 years ago, he had a back issue or something, and the doctor gave him some prescription opioids, and just like that, he got hooked, had to go through it all over again and start fresh. So he knows, he gets it, this grip of the opioid crisis. They are, by the way, I want to point out, but Hazelton Betty Ford opening a clinic, an outpatient clinic in Bellevue here just in a few months.
So in Tacoma, any talk of safe injection sites?
No. Oh my gosh, they are adamant. Just like Snohomish County, they are absolutely opposed. Not going to happen, and to be honest, it's kind of a slow roll in the Seattle effort at this point.
And we're, of course, in a national emergency over the wall, in part because the president says he wants to keep opioids out of the country. And he talked about how if we could only keep opioids from coming across the border, that would solve it.
And I don't get in these particular what the Pierce County officials and again Snohomish County officials tell me is we can't arrest our way out of this problem. That is not their focus. Their focus is on educating, right? They want to figure out how to do some outreach with young people, really make sure kids are not getting in. You heard the overdose rate increase in Pierce County is especially among 15 to 34 year olds. So kids are dying from this. They want to make sure that they do that education base, not so much on the enforcement. I do know at the DEA level and some of the law enforcement agencies, that's something they focus on is that, you know, pipeline of the drugs coming in.
And the fire station program, that's up and running now?
That should be starting next month. I will definitely follow up and keep you posted on that one.
Cairo Radio's Hannah Scott. Thank you, Hannah.
You bet.
Jay Inslee is going to be on Face the Nation this Sunday, one of a large number of Democrats running, in some cases on very different platforms. And every Friday we talk with Margaret Brennan, who hosts Face the Nation. I ask her if there's any concern that the Democratic donor base is going to be able to afford so many Democratic candidates.
There are so many questions about what this incredibly deep bench of candidates for the 2020 Democratic nomination will do to the party itself. Are they eating their young? Are they, you know, sort of at this point not doing any damage because it is so early on in the race? But certainly that battle for dollars is a good question. And from what I've been hearing, you know, a lot of the sort of traditional mainstay donor base has been waiting on the sidelines to see, particularly if some of those bigger names like Vice President Joe Biden or, you know, other so-called centrist Democrats enter the race, what we are expecting is that more will join come end of March, early April. But there are a lot of eyes on, as you said, your governor, Jay Inslee, to see if some of the more progressive wing of the party continues to add to the race. I mean, we already saw Bernie Sanders jump in at the beginning of this week.
Right.
And a lot of what he had campaigned on in 2016 has now become accepted as sort of mainstay party platform issues by DNC members. And Bernie Sanders himself is not a self-described Democrat. Remember, he's still an independent.
I'm curious, what made you interested in having Jay Inslee on?
The governors from around this country are gathering in Washington this week for this Governors Association meeting. So it's a good opportunity to have a face-to-face conversation, which is always better than having one, you know, via satellite, I think, personally. But we want to talk to him not only about the potential race for 2020, but other questions in regarding the challenges to the president and this administration on so many different policy issues. But I want to talk to him personally as a new parent about this measles outbreak in the state of Washington and whether on a federal level there should be more conversation about the anti-vaccine movement because of these hot spots that are breaking out around the country.
Right. On the Republican side, do you see any serious challenge to the president?
The Republican National Committee and the party itself are now the party and party infrastructure of President Trump. They have been remade in the Trumpian image. You can see that through all the articulation of the party platform right now. It is not your grandfather's Republican Party. It is Donald Trump's Republican Party. And that deeply frustrates many more quote-unquote traditional conservatives. Larry Hogan, the governor of Maryland, as you pointed out, is one of them saying, you know, we need to still have a voice. It's a similar argument to what's happening with Democrats right now, which is sort of what makes us part of our party. How do we define our party? And Larry Hogan has said he feels that the RNC is not considering and should be considering a primary challenger to the president in 2020. That is another Republican who could say, I want to represent the Republican Party in this race. The president should not be standing on that ticket as the head and representative of our party. This is not, I would say, a large-scale movement at this point. It's a really interesting conversation to be had because it shows some of the misgivings and divides within the conservative movement about some of the president's decisions that he has made. But as you can see, day in, day out on Capitol Hill, there is a reluctance to publicly challenge the president. There are small cracks that we do see where someone will come out and publicly say what they privately gripe about, and that happens on issues of national security and foreign policy primarily. But to have someone come out as a primary challenger, that still seems like a far cry from where we are.
Are they positioning themselves just in case the Mueller report goes badly for the president?
That's one of the points of speculation as to maybe the party should have a backup plan, or does the president, given his age, truly want to go up for another grueling election cycle? And there are a lot of reasons that you could use to justify the party looking at a primary challenger at this point.
Margaret Brennan, the host of CBS's Face the Nation, Jay Inslee, one of the guests on Sunday. Now here he is, strolling down the red carpet in his handsome sequin tuxedo. I love the hat. Our own award-winning film critic, Tom Tangney. So welcome. Boy, this is your weekend, man.
It is indeed. I'm exhausted, but happy.
You were filling in for Candy and Mike yesterday, right?
Double duty on a four-hour
afternoon.
Show. And I filmed every minute of a four-hour show. I sympathize with you guys.
The Iron Man. So, you've been promoting Roma as your favorite pick to win Best Picture.
Absolutely,
right?
And I think it's the general consensus as the favorite right now, which is amazing. This is a black and white, Mexican film, so with Spanish subtitles and all, and it seems to be the most loved. The question is, will this movie really win? And I think this is the year I thought we ought to look at the preferential voting. I think Roma, if Roma would win on a first ballot, if everybody just voted and like they used to do more than 10 years ago, when they used to just vote, what's your favorite film out of the eight? I think Roma would win pretty much hands down because the people that like Roma love Roma. But because they instituted 10 years ago, Dave, when they expanded, they decided, you know, we need to have more movies to draw more audiences in, that instead of just having five best pictures, let's go up to as many as 10. So like for this year, they have eight. But it's whatever, you have to reach a certain threshold. That's really a mathematical, you know, analysis we don't need to get into right now. But because of the preferential voting, what they did is because they expanded the number of films, they also added preferential voting. And because of that system, sometimes the winner may not be the movie with the most number one votes. And I think that's most apt to happen in a year like this year when Roma, which is a very unusual movie for it to be a front runner, could actually get knocked out by a movie that's a little less loved but more generally liked. So I want to, how can this be? Let me explain here, Dave.
Are you going to go through all these numbers?
I'm not going to go through the numbers. Okay. No, that's, I'm going to refer you to mynorthwest.com. If you want a detailed mathematical analysis of how four or five ballots in a movie that was not number one at the first can top it. No, you go to that, but I'm going to kind of summarize what this works. So when the Academy expanded the number of Best Picture nominees up to 10, it also instituted this preferential voting. That's what I just mentioned. Each voter must rank the Best Picture nominees from first to last. It's these rankings that ultimately determine the winner, unless the top vote getter earns at least 51% in the initial vote. With eight films nominated, that's a pretty tall order to get. You have eight candidates.
Right.
To get 51% is pretty tough. Not impossible, but not especially easy, especially when there's no heavy favorite, say, like Titanic. If no one clears that 50th percentile, then the film with the lowest number of votes is dropped, and those votes are redistributed to the movies that were picked second on those ballots. This continues until one film clears the 50% market. Mark, now let's imagine this scenario on a first ballot in which only the first place votes are counted. Let's say the current favorite Roma garners an impressive 35% of the vote, but nowhere near the 50%. The general consensus, like I said, is that Roma is by far the most loved of all the nominated films, but viewers are very hot and cold about Roma. If you don't love Roma, you're apt not to care for it at all. I imagine Roma might garner the most first place votes and eighth place votes and not much in between. In this scenario, Roma might peak on the first ballot and not get any closer to 50% plus. That gives a movie that is less loved but more generally liked a chance to creep up with each successive rejiggering. Again, I mentioned you can go to MyNorthwest.com for my detailed analysis of just how this could happen. By the fourth or fifth ballot on my imagined scenario, I have Green Book nipping Roma for Best Picture. It could be Black Panther. It could be something that's just more popular. In other words, in this entirely made-up scenario, the first ballot's third-place film in my scenario nips the first place film. Personally, I still think Roma is going to win, but if it doesn't, I imagine it'll be a scenario like this that topples it.
Yeah, okay. So, I mean, you can read the analysis. This is this ranked choice voting, which is being used in Maine for political context.
Yeah, and they're considering in Pierce County now, too.
Yeah, and the whole idea is so there are candidates who wouldn't normally get a chance, even though they're liked by a large number of people, if not, quote, loved.
Yeah.
So the other thing I wanted to get out here was the new format of the Oscars, which is not going to have a host.
Yes.
So how is that going to work? You're just going to have presenters walk out and do their thing and then walk off?
Yeah, you could have like the voice of God. And now, you know, ladies and gentlemen, and you just announce the presenters. I've done this, you know, I go to the Critics' Choice Awards every so often down in Hollywood, and we often don't have a host if it's hard to get somebody, you know, timing. And it really works pretty well. The host is the primary way for the host to operate is to do a great intro, you know, a great monologue.
Yeah.
There might not be a monologue in this case. However, I've also heard that thanks to Bohemian Rhapsody, that maybe Queen will open the show. Now, wouldn't that be a great opening to have Queen on stage performing as a way to kind of get into the movies? There are other ways to work around the host. And you've heard the rumor about Whoopi Goldberg because she's been missing from The View. So the rumor is, hey, maybe there'll be a surprise host in that Whoopi Goldberg, who's done it four other times, she's been missing. She's been sick from her own show, The View, for the last week. And so the suspicion is maybe she's secretly working with the Oscars to surprise people.
Ooh.
Now, the people on The View said, no, she really is sick, and we have one of the hosts is pregnant, and she didn't want to contaminate that. But that's another theory, is that maybe there'll be a pop-up surprise host of the last second.
And the other thing is the idea that Netflix would be taking Best Picture for this.
Yes. That there is a movement against Roma, and part of that movement is because it's a Netflix picture, and yeah. Netflix is encroaching on the major studios. So if you have loyalty, like Steven Spielberg just recently was quoted as saying that he thinks that movies that are made for TV should not be allowed to compete for the Oscars. And even though Roma did play in some
theaters,
play in theaters, but it's mostly available. Like everybody can watch it at any time on Netflix right now.
How do you
now.
Decide if it's up for the Oscars or the Emmys?
Well, the thing is, that's his argument.
Yeah.
The idea is, if it's first off, you might look at who's doing it. I mean, Alfonso Cuarón's already won an Oscar for Gravity, and it's considered like a serious movie. But yeah, they basically it's like a lot of movies that don't open until February, but they get 1 week runs in L.A. and New York to qualify. Yeah. That's sort of what they do. They had a one week run or two of Roma to qualify. That's the only distinction you make. And right now, streaming services. If CBS did it, it would be considered an Emmy. But a streaming service is in that no man's land between movies and TV. And so there's a lot of pushback among Hollywood insiders.
So if they played a few NCIS episodes in theaters, it could be up for an Oscar?
Well, if it was running on Netflix or Amazon Prime, but not on on a major network. Sorry, Dave.
Thanks, Tom.
Bye-bye.
Your daily dose of kindness now. Gotham City might have Batman, but South Hill, Virginia, they have Officer Fleming.
What can I say except you're welcome?
You may have seen the viral video of Officer Fleming belly on the ground playing dolls with a couple of girls.
It was a set of boys that were coloring, and there was a set of girls that were playing with some dolls and their accessories.
He was in the area. The gas leak was called into the apartment complex, and while there, stopped to play. Officer Fleming had no idea, though, that the girl's mother recorded the interaction from her apartment window. WTVR-TV says she then uploaded it to Facebook. She says in that moment, Officer Fleming did more than just play dolls.
It's just amazing the bond that he has with the children, especially around here. My daughter, my niece, and some of the other children here were afraid of cops.
They aren't afraid anymore.
If you ever need me, all you got to do is ask for me, right?
911.
There you go, and that's the perfect number to have too, isn't it?
Fleming is celebrating his 15th year on the police force. He says from the start he set out to do more than just be a cop who writes tickets or is constantly chasing criminals.
My job is here to protect and serve. For me to be a catalyst to young people, regardless of race, color, creed, religion, I feel like I can be a positive change.
Fleming says he hopes his actions and those of his fellow police officers in Virginia would lead to real change in police and also the community relations.
It's very important to see the connection he has, especially with these group of kids that I see every day. They need someone who they can feel is a superhero.
That's their superhero.
Wow. And a well-deserved. I haven't seen the video, but I'll bet it's
so cute.
Priceless,
yeah, because he's, he just really gets in there, belly to the ground, laid out, playing with the dolls. And it was a short interaction, but it was enough to change how those two little girls saw police officers. And I don't know if it's needed to be pointed out, but the two little girls are black. The officer is white. So, for the mother, it had deeper meaning of I want them to be able to trust and know and reach out to officers if they need help. And in that instant, he did that for them for the rest of their lives.
7:39. Chris, what's your traffic headline?
Starting to see more slowing northbound 167 getting out of the Puyallup area. I'll tell you about it next.
This is Cairo Radio. Jesse. Now it's time for the Sports Insider from your Western Washington Toyota dealers. And here he is from that Three Ring Circus of Sports, 710 ESPN. Danny O'Neill, deal with these rumors about Russell Wilson.
Well, we have to. Do you want me to start with my opinion of the rumor? Do you want me to explain?
Well, first of all, where did it come from?
Colin Cowherd, who is an FS1 sports talk show host, doesn't cover the team on a day-to-day basis. And what he said is, this is making the rounds among entertainment agents. This is what people in the entertainment industry are saying. Is that Sierra, Russell Wilson's wife, would like to be in New York, and the Giants need a quarterback, so you do the math.
Why does she want to be in New York? Isn't her business in L.A.?
You would think so, but that's what he said, is that people say she'd like to be in New York in a bigger stage.
They always blame the wife or girlfriend, don't they?
You know,
always go for them.
They tend to, yes.
It's her fault.
And then, her doing. And then who is inevitably invoked? Yoko Ono.
Right. She's the Yoko of Russell Wilson. So no, I'm going to call this is false, and Sierra has nothing to do with this. And they make decisions as a couple.
I will say this. There's no reason to think that going to New York would help her career. She's a star.
Yeah.
Like, this isn't, and it's not like she's making music. And if you were going to be an entertainer, it probably would make more sense to be in Los Angeles as opposed to New York. Here's the second tier of this. It doesn't matter if he wants to be in New York because the Seahawks aren't going to trade him to New York. That's not how the NFL works. The soonest he could possibly be a New York Giant would be three more seasons from now.
Three more seasons.
That's the absolute, if it was true that he had his heart set, that he was not going to, I want to be a New York Giant. That's where I want to play. That's where it's best for us. He would still play three more seasons with the Seahawks before we got to the point where he
could
force that.
Are the Giants even competitors?
No, they're terrible.
Yeah.
They're awful. And then we go a step further of, I think, why does the rumor pick up speed? Because it involves New York. And that city's conceit, that city's belief that it's the center of the universe knows no bounds.
The Giants don't even play in New York, do they?
No, they play in New Jersey.
Yeah.
But you go there and you'll hear reporters say stuff like, does it mean more when you win a game here in New York? No, it means the exact same as if you win one in St. Louis or Miami or any other of the cities. This idea, that city.
All it means is that you have a 2-hour drive from the airport anywhere you want to go.
That city could not get over itself if you gave it a grappling hook. So the idea that you then, he really wants to go to New York, you've got a week's worth of fodder there. Look, franchise quarterbacks don't get traded. It doesn't happen. In the past 10 years, I could point to three guys that would be legitimate franchise quarterbacks that have changed teams. And in each case, there's been a very extenuating circumstance where usually you've got an heir apparent. That's Drew Brees, after the 2005 season, went to New Orleans. That was a huge shakeup, a huge change. But the Chargers already had Philip Rivers, who had sat on the bench for 2 years and was the number 4 overall pick. The next one that you come to that you would say, like, okay, that franchise, Brett Favre. But he kept retiring and unretiring. Those types of quarterbacks don't get traded. The Seahawks aren't going to trade Russell Wilson.
Is the Giants practice facility even in New York?
No, I don't think so.
So he...
Well, he'd live wherever he wanted. He'd probably live in Westchester County, right?
Oh, it's a beautiful place.
Yeah.
Oh, my gosh.
Yeah.
On the Hudson. You should get one of the Vanderbilt Mansion, I think, is vacant.
Oh, really?
It's just like a museum.
One of the robber barons?
Yeah. They're all at all those estates. That's what we used to do as kids. We'd visit the biggest.
Go throw states. Rocks at the windows?
No. Break dancing is an Olympic sport. You're the hip-hop expert around here.
Yeah, one of the five elements. One of the five classic elements of hip-hop, break dancing. You also have graffiti, emceeing, DJing, and knowledge. Break dancing is going to become an Olympic sport.
Yeah, you buy it? It's a sport?
Well, no.
Okay.
No.
The pentathlon then. So you have to do the graffiti, then you do the breakdancing, then you do the DJ, and then what's the knowledge sport? How would that be?
You just got to have the understanding of the way the world works.
You got to know the ledge.
Yeah.
Know the ledge.
That is an Eric B. and Rakim reference. Yeah.
Why am I learning getting
Dave's
all my hip-hop knowledge from
right
white
now.
People?
Yeah, that's a very good question.
Just think of the advertising possibilities. I mean, this cardboard box brought to you by Pizza Hut that you're going to lay down and do your breakdancing on, or, you know, United Movers or whatever.
I will say this. It's as much a sport as ice dancing or rhythmic gymnastics.
It's athletic, but not a sport, in your opinion.
Yes.
Yeah.
It is an incredibly athletic activity. I'll enjoy watching it, but I also enjoy the modern pentathlon, which is
what
it's cross-country skiing and shooting.
Oh, yes.
Which is extremely useful. That's actually what Swedes call shopping.
I found myself.
Oh my gosh, you're on fire today.
I'm going to go out shopping. I got some rabbit, honey. Oh, did you go down? I skied a mile down the trail and shot little bunny foo-foo.
Why do we not have a drum riff roll for Danny's segment?
You don't need it. He's his own drummer.
I'm my own something.
Yeah.
So why do you think Paris is trying to do this, just to bring attention to their games?
They try to introduce things to keep it current. Mm-hmm. Like
and breakdancing is them keeping it current.
Well, you've had a resurgence.
It's been around for a long time.
Oh, yeah. I like to look at this is one thing we can win. We should dominate, right? We should definitely clown the stupid French in this.
Yeah.
Like, when it comes to breakdancing, we've got a decade head start
French
on that.
French don't breakdance, do they?
I don't think so.
I wouldn't think they can.
Oh, electric.
Actually, you know,
they have plenty of street performers.
You know what? The French are known for their moonwalking backwards. The ability to back away from a fight. Yeah. No. Oh. Do you remember what happened in World War II?
Oh, don't give me all that again. The thing is, you would never, I mean, breakdancing involves like spinning on a sidewalk, right?
Yes.
You don't want to touch those French sidewalks.
Are they foul?
But that's why you bring your cardboard box out.
Yeah. Oh, so anyway.
Man. So much to learn.
Danny O'Neill, the man who travels with his own rim shot. Good to have you here.
All right. I'm going to go shopping.
Go ahead.
Talk to you soon.
And he is armed. Hannah Scott is here. How many days left in the session?
About half.
We're about halfway through?
Yeah, about half.
Well, they got a lot going on. There's this payroll deduction for long-term health care. There is a gas tax hike and a carbon tax to pay for a new transportation plan. And my favorite thing, year-round daylight saving time. So let's start with the payroll deduction. What's that about?
So this has become a pretty controversial idea, but with most of us not doing enough to save and prepare for long-term health care needs, Representative Laura Jenkins says the state needs to step in by creating the long-term care trust account. Jenkins got emotional when describing who she was dedicating her yes vote to on the House floor yesterday.
My mother-in-law, Jeanette. She's 93 years old. In her late 80s, she started to get very forgetful, and eventually she couldn't live alone. And my wife and I watched her spend her entire life savings down to nothing until she finally qualified for Medicaid. And then only 3 months after she qualified for Medicaid, her assisted living facility that she was living in announced that they were closing. And so she was left destitute with no money to pay for other services.
So Jenkins' bill would work like unemployment insurance or a new paid family medical leave program where every worker in the state has premiums taken out of their paycheck to fund this account, whether they want to or not. And then later they can use up to $37 in benefits, up to $100 a day, if they qualify, to help pay for things like nursing home care, in-home care, meal delivery assistance. The key part of this was allowing family members who take time off of work to care for a loved one to get reimbursed with this money to be paid. So that was a big step. It failed last year because it didn't have that. Huh. So now it has more
support. Medicaid does not take care of everybody. I thought that, as she mentioned, if you're destitute, there's Medicaid, and there's always some facility somewhere you could go to.
Right. So that's the idea. As she described there, you have to do the spend down, right? You have
to get
rid of all your assets and everything you have in order to qualify for that Medicaid. The idea here is that hopefully this will allow you to avoid having to get to that level where you have there's enough assistance to keep you from having to go on Medicaid and spending all your money down.
Okay, gas tax hike.
We have a massive bill. Remember a few weeks ago we talked about Steve Hobbs had this draft idea that he put out there, $16.3 billion 10-year plan to do, you know, every transportation need we need. It was a draft idea. He did a work session, wanted to see what the feedback might be and decide whether it was some of it would become a bill. All of it became a bill yesterday. He says he got enough positive feedback to make it happen.
Think of it as another option in the plate of different options dealing with the environment and infrastructure. The only difference is this is the only one that deals with all of our infrastructure needs and environmental concerns. This is the only one that does that, plus provides 65,000 jobs, too, in the meantime.
As far as how to pay for it?
It is a carbon tax, and there's other revenue sources as well, but it provides infrastructure. So the bridge over the I-5 River is one in Clark County. The trestle of my neck of the woods is another. You have the building of 5 new electric ferries, the conversion of ferries. There's 405, 522, and I can just go on and on. And that's on the infrastructure side.
So that's all the transportation stuff.
So how much does this raise the price of gas?
Well, so the carbon fee would be worked out. It would be about the same as what we expected, I think, 4 cents or so on that from the carbon fee. The gas tax hike, though, is 6 cents, would be 6 cents.
So there's two different things. I thought gas tax and carbon fee were sort of wrapped together.
No, the bulk of this program is paid for by the $15 per metric ton carbon tax, and then the idea of that increasing your gas payments is going to be that it trickles down, right? That
the carbon tax also then applies to your power bill, right? Because if you're
right, there's trickle down for all of that.
Is there bipartisan support for this?
Right. Listen. So here's the I want to point out, too, so we've got a 6-cent gas tax hike.
Right.
This also has a whole lot of other funding measures. It's going to double your HOV violation fees. It's going to add a 50-cent surcharge to all your Uber rides, a variety of things. It's a big, big, huge proposal. I'll have it all up in detail on My Northwest later today. As far as chances for it passing, here's what he had to say about that.
If you would have asked me this, like the beginning of session, I'd say, oh, man, this doesn't have a chance, but at least we'll get the discussion going. And now that I have multiple signatures, it's senators from both sides, you know, both caucuses signing on to them. And what a great hearing I had a couple weeks ago. I went, Mom, this thing might have a chance. Because I think people out there know that there are needs out there that we need to address. And at the same time, there's these environmental concerns.
So this rolls all of that into one. He does have quite a bit of bipartisan support on these bills. It came in the form of three different bills. And he seems really positive about it, as you can hear right there. And again, when I told you I sat in on that whole work session, it was like 3 hours a couple of weeks back.
Uh-huh.
And I expected to hear all this opposition. And,
yeah.
and so it really
no
wasn't.
Striping.
There wasn't a lot in that work session, and I haven't heard anything. Again, this just dropped yesterday afternoon, so we'll see how it moves forward.
Man,
but
just patch up the Ship Canal Bridge. That's right.
This is for everything, right? This is for bridge repairs, new roads, everything that doesn't work now and that's crappy right now. It's going to invest in all of that, changing our environmental stuff. It's going to be great.
And it also includes tolling.
It does include tolling.
For the trestle,
yes,
I know all the people that live up in Hobbs District, they were wondering, the tolling, but it's a different, it's not going to be a congestion price toll. This is going to be like an old toll that we saw when they built the Astoria Megler Bridge, like over the toll goes to paying for the new
bridge.
And I want to make clear, because we were not clear on this at the work session because he hadn't decided yet, this would be for a new Highway 2 trestle, 4 lanes on the westbound direction. 2 of those lanes would be tolled, 2 would be general purpose. Tolling would not be done on the current old trestle. It would only be done once the new one's in place.
Okay. I mean, anything that gets us state-of-the-art highways, I just can't emphasize enough. And we spent our summer, in Scandinavia traveling on those highways. They're smooth. I mean, those are serious highways where you could go 100 miles an hour and not even know it, because they're actually, they're planed, they're smooth, and we don't have anything like that.
No.
Yeah, like I-80, across the Midwest all the way to New York.
Right.
I mean, going through Ohio, every couple of miles, ding,
yep,
ding, ding. And then if you want to, you can go and eat at Bob's Big Boy up over the top of the freeway at the rest area. But yeah, I mean, I have no problems that they pay for and maintaining the roads with that. It's a user fee. It needs, let's face it, how they fund it, I don't know, Anna. That's all for people to discuss. What I do know, we need these repairs. We're so far behind in our infrastructure, especially with the growth that's happened here.
And it really is, and that's his point. Look, these needs aren't going away, so this is going to be a big deal. It'll be a discussion, I'll be sure, and both Sully and I will watch this as it goes forward. I want to point out, carbon tax has failed about 2 times by the voters. He says this is different. This will make sure that this money is shown as dedicated going to these transportation needs.
And daylight saving time.
So that just cleared a committee last night. I'll keep you posted. It needed, because today is policy cutoff, so that did.
So we would just keep it instead of going back in whatever it is, October, November.
Yeah.
Just keep daylight saving, and so some would be
summer all year long.
All year long. So, but it means in the summer, noon would be 1 o'clock. So the sun would be at its highest point at 1 o'clock instead of noon. Okay.
Yep.
Thank you, Hannah.
You bet.
There's a lot going on there.
Yeah, and again, today is cutoff, so I'll be back next week with everything that died.
You have to see the wizard, the wonderful Wizard of Oz.
The Wizard of Oz turns 80 years old this year.
Lions and tigers and bears. Oh, my.
According to the Library of Congress, it is the most seen film in movie history, and it was nominated for 6 Oscars, including Best Picture, which it lost to Gone with the Wind. But The Wizard of Oz did win 2 Oscars for Best Original Song and Best Original Score. And one of the film's last surviving cast members lives right here on Mercer Island. 98-year-old Meredith Glass was an extra in the film back in 1939.
I was 18. The reason I was able to be in The Wizard of Oz as an extra was because my cousin's was Mervyn LeRoy, and he was a producer, and he produced The Wizard of Oz. I was a green lady. I think there must have been 100 of us.
Mervyn LeRoy was a famous Hollywood producer and director who was once married to the daughter of one of the Warner Brothers, and as the stories go, discovered Clark Gable. Like Meredith mentioned, she was a green lady, one of the many women dressed in green that appeared in all the big crowd scenes.
We were in Emerald City. We extras were talking quietly and laughing and, just wasting time. All of a sudden, we heard this wonderful voice, and it was over the rainbow. And slowly we stopped talking, and it was absolutely breathtaking moment for me and everybody else.
One day I'll wish upon a star and wake up where the clouds are far behind.
And after it was over, we just all clapped and yelled and waved, and it was absolutely a moment for me, and one that I'll never forget. To this day, you know, I see a rainbow, and it comes right back to me. You know, that moment comes back.
Beyond the rainbow, why, oh, why?
Meredith and Judy Garland were both 18 years old, and they struck up a friendship.
Judy was fantastic person. She really was. We had fun. Like when she got her first car, she drove it on the set, you know, that was a big deal. And we all piled in and running around the running around MGM in the car, you know, and waving at everybody. And that's the kind of a gal she was.
Sadly, Judy Garland passed away from a drug overdose when she was just 47, an addiction that began on the set of The Wizard of Oz. The studio wanted her to lose weight, and they gave her what they called pep pills to suppress her appetite and give her energy. Then, at night, they'd give her sleeping pills to calm her down.
MGM had a doctor that they sent people to, and I even was sent there. Because sometimes you're working all night long, and it was very difficult at times. I think she got hooked on them. I threw mine away. Sleeping pills.
Meredith lives in the Covenant Shores retirement community. And this Friday, they're celebrating the film's anniversary with a red carpet reception. Residents will dress up. There'll be dinner. Meredith will be signing autographs. And then they'll screen The Wizard of Oz.
Oh, I haven't seen it for a long time. It's in me. I've seen it. You know, it's part of me.
You're off to see The Wizard, the wonderful Wizard of Oz.
I didn't realize that about the pills.
Yeah, I didn't either. I heard a little bit while I was interviewing Meredith, and then I went online and I did some research, and yeah, it's very sad. It's terrible. And you look at what she looks like in that film and you think, she was overweight? They called it her baby fat.
Crazy. Such a charming and a big part of course, my generation's growing up, and even my parents' generation, because it came out during the Depression and was so cheerful and positive. And to hear the backstory sometimes is disillusioning.
It is. I did a deep dive yesterday, and just reading about how much the story changed before they settled on this story. Mm-hmm. This was one of the first color films. This was one of the first talkies. And what was cool for me is I've seen this many times, you know, since I was a kid, and I listened to the songs in a completely different way. They'd become almost white noise to me, just mm-hmm. I mean, beautiful, but still just songs that you know so well. Everybody knows those songs. I never stopped to just listen to her voice, and I didn't know she was 18, and this was the beginning of her career and how exciting that must have been. And so as I was listening, I just was really thinking about it differently. And that story, I mean, I put it together, it took me, you know, time to edit it, but just listening to it now, it gave me chills, and I had the hair on my arm standing up because it just seemed so special.
Did Meredith know at the time that she was part of cinematic history?
No. And Meredith wanted to be an actress, but she was very shy. And she said she didn't have the confidence and the self-esteem. So her cousin, you know, put her in this role. Then as soon as she got married, she completely stopped all of it.
Rachel Bell. Thanks, Rachel.
Thank you, Dave.